issue of Life magazine of August the 20th, there appeared a very important, thought-provoking article called Why Ministers Are Breaking Down. The author, Reverend Wesley Schrader, a prominent Baptist minister of many years, and now teaching at Yale Divinity School, recounts case after case which have come to his attention of ministers who, though separated by age, geography, and financial resources, had one thing in common. They were victims of emotional breakdowns. He states in his article that mental and emotional breakdowns among our ministers, regardless of denominations or position, are occurring in increasingly large numbers every year. Breakdowns among ministers have become so numerous that in some of the areas of our country, congregations have begun to require prospective ministers to submit to psychiatric examinations. Well, that's good as a general principle, not only for ministers, but also for laymen. Most people assume that a minister, a man of God, a man of faith, should be immune from such emotional breakdowns. But however dedicated and sincere these clergymen are, and perhaps because of their very dedication and sincerity, which on the average is very high among them, they are subject, nevertheless, to the physical and emotional factors which in many cases operate among the laity. Now, what is the explanation that this author gives for these many breakdowns among the clergy? Dr. Schrader, who has counseled many emotionally disturbed clergymen, states, and I quote from the article, "It lies principally in the fact that the minister's role, as conceived by the members of church organizations, has become impossible. It is a role that no individual human being, not even one of the 12 apostles, could adequately feel. So long as lay people keep demanding more of their ministers than they can deliver, ministers are going to continue to break down regardless of their mental and emotional health at the beginning of their pastorates. The men who make the best impressions on their new congregations are the hard, conscientious workers, determined to fulfill all of their obligations. And it is these same men, so often superior in every way, who suffer the breakdowns. Such a minister knows that his people expect him to fulfill their unrealistic expectations. He tries, but he fails. Again he tries, and again he fails. And fear of failure, America's unpardonable sin, grips him. A sense of frustration gnaws at him. Guilt plagues him because he has not done the job. He is caught and broken. And that is the cycle. Fear, frustration, and guilt." Dr. Schrader is supported in his contentions by an eminent sociologist, Dr. Samuel Blizzard, a professor of sociology at the Pennsylvania State University, who has been conducting a survey of some 700 American Protestant ministers. A survey on the role that lay people expect of their minister, and on the role that ministers expect of themselves. And his conclusions, and again I'm quoting, "The new American culture has resulted in a change in what people expect of the minister," declared Dr. Blizzard. "In the past, the parish clergyman has performed his functions as a general practitioner. Now, increasingly, he is expected to be a specialist. And he's expected to be a specialist not in one or two, but in six separate roles: administrator, organizer, pastor, preacher, priest, teacher. As administrator, he is responsible not only for the church's financial upkeep and physical maintenance, but must act as general overseer of all those connected with its work. As organizer, he must provide the spark for church societies, fundraising drives, and special events. As pastor, he looks out for the spiritual welfare of his flock, watchful for any individual who needs his help. As preacher, his sermons give constant guidance in the relation of God to man. And as priest, he administers the sacraments and conducts weddings and funerals. And as teacher, he must direct the church's entire religious educational program. And more important even than this superhuman requirement of six specialties is the fact that ministers and their congregations are in wide disagreement as to the relative importance of the specialties. Today's congregation, Dr. Blizzard finds, place the highest value upon the minister's roles as administrator and organizer. They regard less highly the roles of preacher, teacher, and priest. The minister, on the other hand, places the greatest emphasis on his role as preacher and teacher and priest, and puts least emphasis on the roles as administrator and organizer. And the result is insoluble conflict and ultimate frustration. This survey of Dr. Blizzard reveals that the average urban minister works 10.5 hours a day, 7 days a week. And from the standpoint of time alone, this is an enormous strain. A minister from North Carolina sent out a questionnaire to his congregation, asking them to tell him how much time they thought he should give each week to each of the following jobs. And the following jobs are the following: studying and preparing his sermons and addresses, personal counseling, administering the affairs of the church, board meetings, committee meetings, budget planning, building programs, financial campaigns, calling on members of the congregation, calling on newcomers to the community, conducting young people's activities, preparing for marriage and performing weddings, comforting the bereaved, and conducting funerals, taking part in denominational work, aiding community activities such as the Red Cross, YMCA, YWCA, Boy Scouts, school boards. But he sent out a questionnaire to his congregation asking them to indicate how much time they thought their ministers should devote to each of these activities. The average work week indicated by the answers of the members of the congregation totaled 82 hours. One answer proposed a schedule of 200 hours, actually 32 more hours than there are in a week. Now, such a schedule as was given in the questionnaire sent out by this minister from North Carolina, declares the Life article, may come as a surprise to the layman who thinks of his minister as one who works hard on Sundays but does not have much to do during the rest of the week. Some of you must have the same thought. But it would not surprise any conscientious minister. Now, the author maintains that at no time was the service of the dedicated minister so much needed and so much asked for as in these troubled times. And he maintains that the demands made upon the conscientious minister are so great as to cause a progressive breakdown on the part of many of them. What are the remedies, according to this article? The size of the church membership should be controlled in relation to the ministerial staff of the church. No one pastor can minister properly to a church with a membership of more than 500. And when it is not feasible to hold down the size of membership, and is not always feasible, then additional full-time ministers should be added to the church staff. He suggests one minister to each 500 members within the church would be a sensible ratio. And such a church instead of having one senior minister with a half a dozen assistants, we'll have a minister of preaching and teaching, a minister of counseling and pastoral care, a minister of education, a minister of church administration. In the old arrangement, the senior minister, who is usually the preaching minister, invariably finds that his organizational and administrative duties are multiplied when he is given assistants who are directly responsible to him for their programs and decisions. But in the new arrangement, each minister is a complete charge of his own work and is responsible to the same board of authority representing the congregation, the elders, or the deacons, or the vestry, or the directors. Though this is not a perfect ministerial staff plan, it has a number of features to commend it, not the least being the possibility of making the minister's weekly schedule more reasonable. Now, much of this, of course, applies to the modern rabbi as well. There have been cases of breakdowns among them too, and for the same reasons. Many modern rabbis feel themselves harassed and driven, and are working on impossible schedules. For the functions of the rabbi today and the demands which are made upon him are in many ways different, quite different. What were the functions of the rabbi of a few generations ago, and traditionally the functions of the rabbi? A sizable and well-organized Jewish community in the old world, in the past, was well-staffed, and the religious functions of the community were variously allocated. They were not all centered in the rabbi, as the trend seems to be today. A congregation had its chazan, its cantor, who not only read the service or chanted the service, but performed many other functions in the life of the congregation, including weddings and funerals. Each congregation had, of course, each community, its staff of teachers, its melamdim. It also had its Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the academy for the training of the older men in the community, or for the training of scholars. There was the Magid, the professional preacher. There was the Shamus, who performed many important duties of the sexton in the life of the congregation. Many of the duties which have now been placed upon the shoulders of the rabbi were in olden days performed by the shamus. And then there was the rav, the rabbi, the teacher par excellence, the spiritual guide of the community or of the congregation, if it happened to be a large community, the one who supervised the religious life of the community, the one who decided questions of law which were brought to him. He was the scholar. His principal duty was to study. Jewish communities insisted that their rabbis set aside hours each day for study. That's why he was a rabbi. For the lips of a priest should guard knowledge, and men should seek instruction from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. Now, in our congregations today, Reform congregations, to an extent also conservative congregations, the rabbi is called upon to conduct the services, to conduct classes, to prepare children for confirmation, to supervise the religious school, to preach, and preaching itself is almost a full job for a conscientious preacher. To visit the sick, the aged, in homes, in hospitals, to officiate at weddings and funerals, to pay social visits. And woe betide the rabbi who doesn't make regular social visits. The bitterest enemies of a rabbi are those whom the rabbi did not visit time that he was expected to call and visit. He's the counselor. Men and women, adolescents, come to him very often for advice, for counsel in troubled situations. He is called upon to work with a network of lay committees in the congregation, frequently saddled with administrative and other financial problems, building campaigns in a congregation, And what congregation hasn't a building campaign today? He must also participate, as indeed his congregation wants him to participate, in community life outside the boundaries of his own congregation, to assist the many philanthropic institutions in the community, to participate in the numerous drives and campaigns for worthy community, national and international Jewish causes. He must also take part in civic life, and his congregation wants him to take part in civic life in the non-Jewish world, for he needs to interpret and to represent the Jew and Judaism to the non-Jewish world. In a sense, he is the tribune of his people to the non-Jewish fellow citizens. And along with all that, if he is faithful to his calling, as teacher, as a rav, he should set aside fixed hours for study, koveya itim la Torah. Well, all this, too much work, or too many kinds of jobs, makes the modern rabbi's role quite impossible. And the smaller congregation is only a partial answer, if it is an answer at all. The tasks assigned to the rabbi today are not related to the size of the congregation. The rabbi of an active smaller congregation, especially in a large city, is called upon to do the very same work that the rabbi of a large congregation is called upon to do. He too has to supervise an educational system. He has to teach. He has to plan programs for youth and adults, for brotherhoods and sisterhoods. He has to participate in building programs and financial campaigns. He has to do pastoral work. And when the congregation is small, even more is expected of him as a pastor. There is no excuse for him not to call on all the members of the congregation. And as far as community and civic participation is concerned, the rabbi of the smaller congregation and the rabbi of the larger congregation have the same demands made upon them, determined only by their personal abilities and their appeal. And so that, as the survey indicates, ministers of smaller congregations have the same quota of breakdowns as ministers of large congregations. Now, my judgment, the answer lies principally in a division of functions. Professionally, where possible, that is, by adding rabbis to the staff of a large congregation, and by dividing their work so that each one is entrusted with a special sphere of activities within the religious life of the congregation. But where it is not possible to add an adequate number of ministers to the staff, and it may not be possible, not only for financial reasons it may not be possible, but there are actually not enough rabbis to go around. The great scarcity of ordained rabbis in the United States. Where it is not possible, then there should be, in my judgment, increased lay participation in the total program, not merely the financial program, in the total program of the congregation. Moses, who had many, many duties to perform, even more than a modern rabbi. Moses judged the people. And the people stood about Moses from morning till night and brought to him all their troubles and all their strife. Had to listen to all of them. He had to make the decision from early morning to late at night, until he reached the point where he cried out, "How can I
bear alone the weight and the burden of you and your strife. Echo eso levadi torchachem matachem yodichem. Then his father-in-law, Jethro, who's a very wise man, called him aside one day and said, and I'm quoting from the Bible, "What you do is not good. You and the people with you will wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to perform it alone. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel. Choose able men from all the people, and let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they shall decide themselves, so it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you." And Moses gave heed to the voice of his father-in-law. Now, my dear friends, Jews have forgotten that Judaism is a layman's religion. There were no professional rabbis among our people until the 15th century of the Common Era. No professional salaried rabbis until a few hundred years ago. The rabbi of olden days, the rabbi of the Talmud, the Chacham, the Talmid Chacham, was only the most learned man in the community, himself frequently a businessman or a professional man or a working man, to whom people quite naturally, because of his known wisdom, brought questions of law and sought guidance and instruction from him. But that's all. The Torah was the possession of the whole community. Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Morasha kihilat Yaakov. The Torah which God gave through Moses is the heritage of the whole congregation of Israel. The synagogue was a layman's creation. It was an association of people, a free, voluntary association of people for prayer, for religious study, and for the inculcation of Judaism and the practice of Judaism. And each member of the congregation looked upon himself as a missionary of the faith to his own people. He didn't relegate the duties of spreading Judaism to one functionary or two functionaries, to a rabbi. It was his responsibility. We have unfortunately relegated all Jewish learning and the responsibility of teaching Judaism to the professional rabbinate. Now, Jewish laymen are very active in Jewish community life, and I'm not criticizing them. They're very active in building and maintaining all the noble institutions which Jews in this country and in other parts of the world have built up, and the missionary institutions, hospitals, orphanages, homes for the aged, and all these very fine, greatly needed financial campaigns for overseas relief, for the support of the State of Israel. All these fine activities are largely in the hands, as they should be, in the hands of Jewish laymen, Jewish laywomen. But I wonder, why do not more Jewish laymen train themselves to become active teachers of Judaism to the people around them, and especially to the young? Why is all that left to one or two or three men in the community? Why haven't we got qualified Jewish laymen as we can have, because so many of them have received fine education in our colleges and universities. Why haven't we more of them who can train themselves to lead study groups, clubs for religious education, religious institutes, within the congregation, among its people? In all the Jewish communities of the old world, it was not at all infrequent that a group of laymen, 10 or 12 or 24 of them, would gather once or twice a week to study Mishnah, Mishnayot, Eliyahu, or a book of the Bible, and they were led by one of their own, by a Jewish layman. And so a fine Jewish community would boast of a dozen of such study groups, where Judaism, the ideals of Judaism, the traditions of our faith, were transmitted. I think it's a thing to which Jewish laymen ought to devote their attention now. It's a serious problem. Take this matter of visiting the sick and the aged. This is a great mitzvah, so regarded by our people. Bikur Cholim, one of the great mitzvahs. Nichum Avelim, comforting the mourners, is another great mitzvah. But never, as far as I know of Jewish literature, never were these responsibilities made the exclusive province of the rabbi. Why do not Jewish laymen, through brotherhoods and sisterhoods, collectively dedicate themselves to that responsibility, so that the enormous burdens of the rabbi may be shared, may be eased? There's this matter of counseling, which is becoming more and more important in this age when so many people desperately seek a steadying hand and a word of guidance. There are many laymen in a congregation who are quite capable of giving that kind of counseling, marital advice, counseling to the adolescent, just as much as the rabbi, just so they can qualify themselves for it. Why cannot have such a group of people in a congregation who could share with the rabbi this responsibility? I think this is one way, it's not the only way, of meeting this great problem. Bringing in more of the layman and the laywoman, not merely in the administrative activities of the congregation, but actually in its spiritual and religious functions. And finally, I would suggest, in all humility, that Jewish people ought not to be so demanding of their rabbis. Pastoral work is very important, very valuable. And the modern rabbi has taken over that role, which historically is not a rabbinical role. The rabbi is not principally a pastor. In fact, the very term pastor has no counterpart in Jewish religious thought. But assuming that these pastoral activities are important, valuable, and they make the greatest friends for a rabbi, and they make the greatest enemies for a rabbi, if it is not done. Jews ought to train themselves not to be so demanding in the field, and not to feel so aggrieved and hurt when they do not receive the visit which they expect, and to make allowances Remember that the rabbi is not wasting his time. Jewish laymen, the women can become very intolerant. I had occasion quite recently of someone who asked me to attend the unveiling of a tombstone. And I regretfully told this individual that I do not attend the unveiling of tombstones. And that never in my 40 years of the rabbinate have I attended such an occasion. And she seemed to be outraged. First of all, she thought that the unveiling of the tombstone is one of the major institutions in Jewish religion. And secondly, she somehow felt that I was slighting the memory of the departed by refusing to attend such a ceremony. Now Judaism has no cult of the dead. The great sages of our people even objected to the setting up of tombstones altogether. They said, we do not set up monuments for the righteous. Their deeds are their own monuments. Let's remember our dead, of what they meant to us, of what they did for us and for the community. That's not expressed by setting up a stone over their grave. And if one wishes to set up a tombstone, and it's quite popular today to do so, and the stone is set, and it is unveiled, all that is required is for a member of the family present at the service to read a prayer and to recite the Kaddish. The idea that a rabbi who has already attended the funeral service the year before and is dealing with the mourning and is comforting them, that the rabbi must return a year later in order to avail a tombstone, that is a sort of a demand which is altogether unreasonable and is simply imposes additional task upon an already overburdened rabbi. I say that not in defense of myself, because I have never done it. I will not permit Judaism, as far as I'm concerned, to become a religion of the dead or about the dead or for the dead. Judaism is a religion of life, of the living. Judaism is a message to the living, to the individual, to society. Judaism wants to teach people how to live so as to derive the greatest possible happiness in the world and to help build a good society for everybody. That's our religion. I am appealing to Jewish laymen then in two ways. First, for volunteers to cooperate actively in the religious functions of the synagogue, to become lay assistants to the professional rabbi. And I am appealing to Jewish men and women to be a little more reasonable in this matter of visiting and pastoral. And finally, I should appeal to the layman to demand less of the rabbi and more of himself in relation to the synagogue and the temple. Well, it's an interesting article. It gave me an opportunity to get a few things off my chest. that my reward will be if I do hear from some men and women in the congregation who will offer their services in a consecrated spirit to the kind of work which the rabbi, as rabbi, is called upon to do in the congregation.
Came to an end. And I mean, of course, as far as his physical existence on earth is concerned. His real life will never end. What was significant about his life can never end. In 1,000 years from today, men will speak and write about Albert Einstein whenever and wherever. Men will recount the story of the progress of civilization and of man's heroic enterprise to unravel the mysteries of the universe and to harness its forces to the service of man. We are a privileged generation that such a man lived in it. And we are a privileged people that such a man belonged to it. I venture to say that our generation will be remembered because of him. And our people will grow in pride and self-esteem whenever they recall him. Human progress, my dear friends, comes about through revelation and through personality. That is, through knowledge, which is sometimes independent of experience, but which is in time verified by experience, and through great human personalities, through character. Character which is strong and courageous enough to defend knowledge and truth, and by so doing, carve new highways for the advancing spirit of man. Albert Einstein possessed both. He was a channel of great new revelations, of knowledge and of scientific truth. And he possessed character, which enabled him to stand by not only the new insights which he discovered in the face of the most violent opposition, but to stand by also the basic moral and ethical principles of mankind generally, and the indispensable values of society, which were so bitterly and ruthlessly attacked in his day, most especially in his country. And I believe that it is this rare combination of revelation and of unique personality in one man, which so captivated the imaginations of the masses of the world. In the face of this, which is after all a miracle and a mystery, men and
and women in all walks of life all over the world, most of whom were unable to understand even the rudiments of the abstruse scientific theory of this theoretician in the field of mathematical physics, whose abstract speculations defied common sense. I say, in spite of this fact, the masses really never understood the involved and profound scientific theories and doctrines of Albert Einstein. They nevertheless stood in reverence of him, and what is even more revealing and complimentary, in love and admiration of him. No man coming from the cloistered halls of science was ever the popular hero of so many adoring millions as was Albert Einstein. He was acclaimed not only by savants and scientists, by universities and by governments. Honors were showered upon him from all over the world, including the Nobel Prize. He was acclaimed not only by these, but by the people in the street who welcomed him wherever he appeared as a conquering hero. This shy, modest, and retiring man who shunned publicity, who blushed and was terribly embarrassed whenever men praised him, was the idol of the masses, who sent something very heroic and spectacular in his personality, something monumental and prophetic. Because of him, they somehow felt encouraged. They were proud of their shared humanity. They somehow felt more hopeful and more elevated because of him. This is the amazing legend which a tremendous personality creates even during its lifetime. And their link with him was not only man's instinctive reverence for great intellectual power. Men do have an instinctive reverence for inventors and discoverers, for the revealers, the great healers of mankind, for the pathfinders of the world. And the masses, all people, somehow were aware, even in a very vague and indistinct way, that Albert Einstein had opened new doors upon the universe, had revolutionized scientific thought, and had given mankind a new vision, a new conception of the structure of the universe. They came to realize, even those who were unscientifically trained, that by providing a new formula for the transformation of mass into energy, he had made possible the fruitful exploration of nuclear energy and so ushered in a new age for mankind. The atomic age. And they sensed that there was something colossal about these achievements, whose consequences for the progress of the human race would be immeasurable. But I venture to say that their admiration for him was not due solely on this account,
It was also due to something else. Beyond the revelation, there was the personality. Albert Einstein, in their eyes, stood for the conscience of mankind. He stood four square for all that mankind held sacred, for freedom and tolerance, for the inalienable human rights, and for compassion and pity and justice. And they knew that Albert Einstein had only believed in these sacred values of the human race, that he fought for them and suffered for them and was denounced and proscribed and execrated for them and was exiled because of them, for that he remained under all conditions of attack, pressure, steadfast, to the greater glory of humanity and as a superb tribute to the inviolable spirit of man. Albert Einstein lived through one of the most tempestuous, tragic, and revolutionary periods in European and world history. And through the major part of his life, he was a world-renowned figure. And he was caught in all this web of world events. And in the bitter social and economic and political conflict of the years, even though he himself tried to avoid becoming involved in them, he tried to steer clear of politics. He was never greatly interested in politics. He wanted to devote himself exclusively to his scientific research. But no one of the character of Albert Einstein could remain isolated in his scientific ivory tower when the whole structure of the world during the period of the two world wars was threatened with collapse. Almost unawarely, he found himself time and again in the arena, in the very midst of the maelstrom, in the arena doing battle for the endangered spirit of man, fighting against all forms of tyranny, against militarism, against chauvinism, against racialism, and against all the rebels against light who were so numerous in the last two generations. He couldn't understand it himself, how he came to be involved. In a moment of introspection, he analyzed himself. And he said, my passionate interest in social justice and social responsibility has always stood in curious contrast to a marked lack of desire for direct association with men and women. I am a horse for single harness, not cut out for tandem or teamwork. I have never belonged wholeheartedly to country or state, to my circle of friends, or even to my own family. These ties have always been accompanied by a vague aloofness and the wish to withdraw into myself increases with the years. And yet this retiring man. Was in the forefront of the battles for human liberation in more than a generation. Though born in Germany, where he received his early schooling, his family moved to Italy when Albert was 15 years old, and he was soon sent to Switzerland to continue his education. In the course of time, he became a Swiss citizen, and it was in Switzerland that Albert Einstein first published his epoch-making scientific papers. It was there in Zurich that he first occupied the post of a professor of physics. But at the age of 34, in 1913, just before the First World War, Albert Einstein was invited to come to Germany to become the director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Physical Institute, and to be made a member also of the Royal Prussian Academy of Sciences. And it was in Berlin that Albert Einstein remained, with occasional visits abroad, periods of teaching in universities abroad, like in Pasadena, California. It was in Berlin that he remained until Hitler's rise to power. Thus, during the 20 most turbulent years in the history of Germany, the First World War, the defeat of the German armies, the collapse of the German Reich, the fall and the abdication of the Kaiser, the establishment of the Weimar Republic, the rise of Nazism, the spread of anti-Semitic racialist propaganda, the assassination of Walter Rathenau, the Jewish Minister of Foreign Affairs of Germany, and the persecution of the Jews. Through these 20 turbulent years, Albert Einstein lived, worked in Berlin. And while honors were showered upon him during those years from all parts of the world, his life became increasingly embittered. What he saw all around him in Germany, but what he experienced as a free spirit and as a Jew. So that in 1932, with Hitler in power in Germany as Chancellor of the Reich, beginning to purge all Jews from public life and from all educational posts, Albert Einstein decided to become a permanent exile from Germany to live abroad. Nazi propaganda from the very start singled out Albert Einstein for its special target of attack. In the first place, he was the supreme living repudiation of their basic thesis that only the Nordic race is capable of producing genius, and that the Semitic race was mongrel and decadent and intellectually sterile. But here was Einstein, a Jew, whom the whole world acclaimed as the foremost living physicist, and a genius of first water. And the world even praised Germany for producing such a genius. And that wouldn't do at all to the Nazis. Einstein had to be discredited. The theory of relativity had to be laughed out of court. He was a frivolous inventor of fantastic hypotheses, they said. And they found a mouthpiece in a prominent pro-Nazi German scientist, Philipp Lenard, who spearheaded their campaign against Einstein. He told the world that Einstein represented the Asiatic spirit inside. He told the world that it is unworthy of a German to be the intellectual follower of a Jew. Natural science, properly so called, is of completely alien origin. And Germans must today also find their own way out into the unknown. Heil Hitler. Now the militarists of Germany and the Junker class had been defeated in the First World War. And they blamed their defeat on a stab in the back. It was the whole front that had collapsed. And responsible for this collapse were the Democrats and the pacifists and, of course, the Jews. And this was the text of all the post-war propaganda of the monarchists and the rightists and the militarists and all the anti-Republican forces in the Reich, all directed against the German Republic. Albert Einstein was a Democrat, a pacifist, and a Jew, and a stout defender of the German Republic. Hence the thunderbolts of Nazi hatred played around his head. Hitler grouped all the democratic forces and elements in Germany into one category, Bolshevik. He succeeded in undermining the German Republic by raising the cry of communism, just as some in our country are intent upon undermining freedom of all kinds by raising the cry of communism. Albert Einstein was never a communist. He even refused to visit Russia. Upon repeated invitation, for fear that his visit there would be interpreted as a political endorsement of the Soviet regime, which he decried because of its suppression of human liberty. Unlike many British scientists and writers who flocked to Russia, Albert Einstein consistently refused to visit the Soviet Union, even to attend scientific congresses there. But the Nazis were nevertheless quick to brand him as Bolshevik, and his physics as Bolshevik physics, as Jewish physics, as Talmudic physics. And when they came into power with Hitler, they burned his books publicly on the square before the State Opera House in Berlin. And his home near Berlin was ransacked
and sacked by the brown shirts on the allegation that Einstein, whom they denounced as a pacifist, had a huge store of arms hidden in his house. And he was expelled from the Royal Prussian Academy of Science because he dared to criticize the Nazi atrocities. Albert Einstein was a lover of peace. He saw the futility of war. He hated the military clique, the Prussian military caste. He was opposed to military conscription. And for a time, he was an outright pacifist. But when he witnessed the rise of dictatorships in Europe, and their threat not to governments merely, and to the independence and sovereignty of nations, but to the very souls of people, to human rights, when he saw the purposes of these dictatorships to unshackle the human mind and to bring back the Dark Ages, he ceased to be a pacifist. He came to acknowledge that lovers of human freedom and dignity must be prepared to defend them, sometimes even at the cost of war. And he was charged with inconsistency. But to be consistent to a principle and hold on to it to the bitter end, when its consequences become dangerous to the highest interest of civilization, is to be a doctrinaire. Albert Einstein was a scientist, not a doctrinaire. He used principles as working hypotheses to the degree that they yielded socially desirable results. And when conditions demanded it, he made intellectual readjustments. His supreme concern was always not the principle, but the welfare of the free man in the free society. Thus, when he saw the might of the Nazis increasing during the Second World War, it was Albert Einstein who wrote to President Roosevelt and drew his attention to the possibility of making the atomic bomb ahead of the Germans, who were experimenting in that field. It was the making of the atomic bomb which hastened the termination of the Second World War. But when Einstein became aware of the dangerous implications of atomic warfare and the menace involved for the future of mankind, he was among the first to call for a control of this atomic bomb, so it would not destroy civilization. His experiences with Nazism, what he saw of the gradual whittling away of human liberties in Germany and how a democracy can be undermined, made him terribly sensitive to any attack upon human freedom. And so after he became a citizen of the United States, and in recent years beheld forces quite analogous to the dark forces of Germany,
rising up in this country to undermine human freedom under one pretext or another. He warned the American people. Sometimes his warning was accompanied by admonitions and advice, which is not entirely necessary on the American scene, where the traditions of democracy were far longer established and entrenched than was the case in Germany. And when he saw the Congressional Investigation Commission violating basic human rights in their quest for information, you may recall that he advised one who turned to him for counsel, refused to testify, even if it meant imprisonment, for he feared that unless people rose up against this threat and resisted it in Gandhi fashion, as he said, that ultimately the enshackment of the American people would take place, even as the enshackment of the German people took place. Perhaps his advice was unwarranted. Had he known America longer, he may have refrained from giving this particular type of advice, but it was certainly motivated by a profound love for America, for democracy, for the things for which America stands. Albert Einstein was a proud and loyal Jew. He had not been educated much in his childhood or early youth in the religious traditions of his people. He had some Jewish education in the gymnasium, where religious instruction was compulsory for all religious groups. There was little of the positive Jewish value in his home background. And this was true of many young Jews at the turn of the century. Assimilationist tendencies were rife among them, among German Jews. But Albert Einstein, as he grew older, came to appreciate the spiritual and ethical values of Judaism and its high codes of human conduct, of brotherhood, and of peace. He came to appreciate the plight of his fellow Jews in many parts of Europe. And subsequently he experienced the fierce anti-Semitism in his own country. And all these factors combined made him more aware of his Jewish responsibilities. Albert Einstein became an ardent Zionist, not out of any nationalistic fervor, but out of his great humanity, and out of a great and mystic loyalty for his people, out of a desire to replenish their self-esteem and their dignity, which were being so violently attacked, and out of a great compassion for the persecuted and the hounded among his people. It was these factors, along with his great admiration for the brave culture, which he believed would receive a new birth in a Jewish homeland. But Albert Einstein became an ardent advocate of the Zionist cause. In fact, his first visit to America in 1921 and to Cleveland was in connection
with the Zionist movement. And it was then that I had the first opportunity and the privilege of making the acquaintance of Professor Einstein. And I was privileged through the years to see a good deal of him, mainly in connection with the Zionist movement. And always found him to be reverent of Jewish values, deeply loyal and proud of his people, and eager to help. This week, the State of Israel is celebrating its 7th anniversary. Albert Einstein had a hand in establishing the State of Israel. He had a hand in establishing the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, greatly interested in its progress. He believed that a Hebrew University could become a bridge between the Eastern and the Western world. He was a loyal Jew, but he was a citizen of the world. He was not parochial in any of his loyalty. His outlook was universal. I should like to say a word about Albert Einstein's religion. A great scientist is not necessarily a great authority on religion. And his opinions in the realms of faith are no more authoritative than of any other intelligent student of the problem. If religion is doing justice and loving mercy and walking humbly with God, Albert Einstein was a profoundly religious man. Though he was not clear in his own mind what he meant, what other men meant when they spoke of God. He never really defined his conception of God, and if ever forced to a definition, Einstein probably would have denied the belief in a personal God. And yet, he spoke often of his, and wrote, of his unshaken belief in the rationality of nature. He spoke of the rational aspect of nature, and that the structure of the universe reveals reason and highest wisdom. He did not believe that nature was mindless. He was not a materialist. And one wonders if Albert Einstein believed that there was reason in the universe, and there must be a reasoning mind in it, a universal mind. And if there is a universal mind, how far is his concept really different from the belief of the religious man that this universal mind laid down the laws not only of what we call physical nature, but of the nature of man as well, and of his ethical and spiritual aspirations. On one occasion, Professor Einstein wrote, "The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mystical. It is the soul of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. To know that what is impenetrable to us
really exist, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which our dull faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This knowledge, this feeling, is at the center of true religiousness. In this sense, and in this sense only, I belong to the ranks of devoutly religious men. On another occasion he wrote, to the sphere of religion belongs the faith that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational, that it is comprehensible to reason. I cannot conceive a genuine scientist without that profound faith. The situation may be expressed by an image. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. Professor Einstein knew the limitations of science. He knew that science can give us information about the correlation of facts in physical nature. It can tell us nothing about aim and purpose and goal. And in an address which he delivered before the theological seminary at Princeton, he wrote, it is clear that no path leads from a knowledge of that which is to that which should be. No matter how clear and perfect our knowledge of present existence, no goal for our human aspirations can be inferred from it. No matter how splendid the knowledge of truth as such may be, as a guide, it is so impotent that it is not even able to establish the justification and the value of this very striving for the knowledge of the truth. The setting up of the most fundamental goals and valuations and their establishment in the life of the individual seem to me to be the most important function of religion in the social life of man. Albert Einstein believed in the value of religious organizations, of churches and synagogues and temples as educational agencies to teach these aims and goals of the ethical and the spiritual life of man. He even approved of rituals and ceremonies, not as sacramental acts, but as educative acts. I doubt then whether a man who speaks and writes and in this vein and who acts out the ethical ideals of religion can in any sense be called an unreligious man. Albert Einstein was not only a scientific leader of men, he was a spiritual leader of men. He led them in the ways of brotherhood and human freedom and social justice and peace. He hated all sham and all pomp and all privilege. He was a friend of man. He was the conscience of humanity in an age where the consciences of most leaders of the world were somehow muted and silenced. He was an individualist, a nonconformist, often a rebel. But always deeply mystically a lover of his fellow men. And so in the generations to come, mankind will treasure the memory of Albert Einstein, not only because of his world-revolutionizing scientific theories, which place him in the category of Copernicus and Newton and Faraday, the world will also remember him gratefully and with blessing in its heart as a great human being, a man who gives dignity to human life by the way he lives and by the manner of his living in testing and searching times. Zecher Tzadik Liberacha. The memory of the righteous is always a blessing.